A history of comedy. It's Seven Old Jacks. A history of comedy.
Come and have a rummage in the archive.
A history of comedy. It's Seven Old Jacks. A history of comedy.
Come and have a rummage in the archive.
Hello and welcome to A History of Comedy in Several Objects, a podcast from the University of Kent about the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive, which exists to preserve material relating to the art and craft of stand-up comedy. In this podcast, in each episode, we pick just one item from the archive to talk about in detail, and then by doing so, we reveal, hopefully, truths and knowledge about the nature of stand-up comedy. I'm Ollie Double. I'm joined by my colleague Elspeth Miller. And we are very much the Gaston and André of comedy archiving.
Oh, I feel like this is a test, like I should know who they are. We've definitely talked about them.
We have.
Oh, no. I feel like I've failed.
You haven't failed at all. But you'll remember, I think, so they were an adagio double act. So that was a sort of form of balancing act, a sort of acrobatic act in variety. And they performed in very sort of, they were a husband and wife, I think, and they were certainly a man and a woman. That's a typical adagio act. So basically, typically, that type of act will involve the man holding the weight of the woman, and you know, she's balanced in all kinds of graceful and improbable positions. Actually, both of them are highly skilled and very physically strong to be able to achieve these feats. But in addition to that, they were theatrical producers. Have you got it?
Yes, we've been looking at the material, haven't we? Or material from them as part of the David Drummond Comedy Collection, as it's now called, and catalogued, actually.
Is it?
According to kind of your arrangement, actually, Ollie. So thank you.
That's okay. Yes, what happened was we were making an acquisition of some material from David Drummond, a massive collection of pantomime material. And as a kind of side thing, we took on some old comedy scripts from the mid-20th century and other material relating to comedy, which literally arrived to us in a bin bag. I'm not sure if we've talked about this before. But anyway, we've been through it all now and started to arrange it in different... Well, I didn't know it had been catalogued. That's exciting.
Fairly recently, yes. So it is now... Yeah, it's now available. And but we did, because you kind of have the expert knowledge and there was absolutely no order to it, we kind of used your order and it's kind of catalogued at sort of series level mainly by performers. So there's kind of an Eddie Reindeer section, there's the Gaston and André section. I think we're going to do an episode about that collection.
We definitely should, because there's, I worked with that material over the summer on a research project I was doing for a book. I was writing a chapter for a book about how comedians work, and it really changed over the course of the 20th century to now. And one of the things was that comedians used to much more buy material. So we have, for example, in that collection, I don't want to sort of anticipate the episode too much that we'll go on to do about it, but there are kind of I can't remember what you call it now, but non-exclusive rights material, so material that you buy, you're allowed to use it with the knowledge that other people are too, right?
So that's
jokes
as well,
absolutely,
as,
you know, yeah. But also we have scripts, the commissioned scripts, so there's a script for at least one review that was put on by Gaston and André. And what's fun about that is it went through the Lord Chamberlain's office. So it's got the blue pencil marks through the bits that weren't allowed through. And it's got a stamp next to it saying deleted by the Lord Chamberlain's office or some such words. And so basically you're licensed to do anything except the things that are deleted. Then you're explicitly not allowed to do those. Gaston and André.
Great.
So... today's episode, there are contesting objects. What were the objects that we were looking at?
I'll start with the non-winner, maybe.
Okay, the non-winner, okay.
So it's a flyer from the Lost Voice Guy collection.
Yeah.
So Lost Voice Guy... real name is Lee Ridley.
Yeah.
And this item is a flyer advertising his show Disability for Dunces, which he took to the Fringe in 2015. So it's a an A5 coloured, very glossy flyer.
On quite thick paper.
It is, yeah. It's really nice quality. It was performed at the Stand. It's kind of got the normal dates of performance, and then it's got sort of questions on the back, which people ask of Lost Voice Guy.
Yeah.
So that's one item.
So that's one item. But that was competing, because this is a fun episode. Mm. If you only just tuned into this podcast, you're in for a treat, because it's the first time we've done this.
Just quickly, I should say, though, that it's called Disability for Dunces, so it's ripping off. Probably shouldn't say ripping off. It's taking inspiration from those, Excel for Dummies, sort of thing.
So the graphic style is similar to the For Dummies series.
Yeah.
But presumably, for copyright infringement reasons, it's for dunces.
For dunces, sorry, yes. Disability for dunces.
Yeah, that's an important point. But the other thing that it's competing for our attention with
is another flyer. This time from Josie Long's collection. It's a benefit called Tell Me Something I Don't Know, which was done for Arts Emergency, the organisation which Josie Long is kind of part of. It's a show, I don't know the year actually, but it had performers. It was hosted by Josie Long, and then it had other performers, including Stuart Lee, Grace Petrie, Sarah Pascoe, Tony Law, Shappi Korsandi. And it was held at the Bloomsbury Theatre. So, and then on the reverse, it's got information about what Arts Emergency does as a charity.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say too much about the items now, because the contest will happen really in an interview that we've got coming up in a little while in the episode. But I mean, that's an amazing lineup, isn't it? And it's a fantastic organisation that Josie's doing there. But the point about this is the interview that we've got is with Lee, with Lost Voice Guy. And how this came about was that he was coming to do a show at the University of Kent for Disability History Month, a show called Blue Badge Comedy, playing on the blue badge thing that, you know, for people with mobility issues, with a form of disability that involves problems with mobility, have on their car. Lee sometimes wears a very funny T-shirt with a sort of parody of the symbol for that, for the blue badge, which says, "I'm only in it for the parking," which I think is great. So just quickly before we get to the interview, the show took place in K Bar in Keynes College, and it was hosted by Matt Hoss, who also put the show together. Matt is obviously involved in this podcast. He's our editor, and has also appeared in an earlier episode. Matt doesn't have a disability, but he basically used his contacts to put together a really great bill, starting with Pete Selwood, I hadn't seen Pete before, but he's really good. It was a difficult gig because it was just in the bar, and there were people there who weren't there for comedy. They were just chatting in the background, which was a shame. Only the people at the front were really sort of there for comedy. But Pete did really, really well with that. And his disability is that he only has one hand. It's very visible that he only has one hand. He can only hold the microphone in one hand. The first thing he did was, as he got to the microphone, was thanked Matt for not adjusting it to his height when he's only got one hand to do that. But he has a really funny joke about the thing that he says he has to mention the hand, because if he doesn't, audiences get really confused, as if they're thinking, does he actually know?
Oh. Right. Well, that's interesting, because that might play into a conversation that you have in the interview later on.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And then there was Shel Byron, who's a comic from Liverpool, who I think her disability is that she suffers from anxiety and depression. So it's not a kind of visible disability, but she was very good too. And then Lost Voice Guy Lee was topping the bill. And we have a clip now of that show, a very short clip of Lost Voice Guy at the K-Bar at University of Kent.
As you may be able to tell, I'm a struggling stand-up comedian who also struggles to stand up. To be honest, I'm not sure which I am worst at. I'll leave the for you to decide. But, just so you know, if you don't laugh at the disabled guy, you are going to hell.
But anyway, before we get to the interview, I thought it might be just interesting. I don't know huge amounts about disability and comedy, but I know a little bit. There's quite a lot, you know, long history of disabled people being involved in comedy. In recent history, I mean, for example, there was a guy called Jag Pla who started out in the 1980s. And I think he was a winner or runner-up in the Hackney Empire New Act of the Year. Certainly, I think there was a connection there. He was an Asian guy who had, I think, cerebral palsy. There's an article here from The Independent in January the 17th, 1989. And it's just a list of comedy listings. So there was a show on Sunday at the Wood Green Trade Union Centre. So that would have been a cast gig, I think. And it says, Jag Pla is a comic who makes his audience uncomfortable by pitching both his race, brackets, he is Asian, and his physical handicaps, brackets, which are severe, into a style of comedy that can be both funny and sad. And he was on with Rob Newman, the Tracy Brothers, and a double act called Post Glasnost, who I remember well and were fantastic. But perhaps that's for another time. So he was around for a little while, but not that long. And then another example from the early 90s, an Australian comic called Steady Eddie, real name Christopher Widows, I think, who again has cerebral palsy, who's still, I think, quite well known, particularly in Australia. In the late 90s into the 2000s, Francesca Martinez, very well known, but not only a comedian, but also an activist, very important. Known, I don't know whether she's that happy about people remembering this all the time, but she was in Grange Hill at one point.
I remember that, yes.
So you remember?
Yeah, I used to watch.
Do you remember what her character was called?
No. Oh.
No, I'm not sure I can. But never mind. That's the thing to Google. That you can join in at home by Googling Francesca Martinez, Grange Hill.
I think she was in the Funny... She's briefly in the Funny Women Collection. I think she was involved in that very first benefit that we spoke about that episode, the 2002...
So that's good, because what we always really enjoy is when there are links between different collections. And then, really importantly, there's an organisation called Abnormally Funny People who started in 2005, and they have performers with a range of disabilities and, you know, very successful group, very important group, more power to them. So, I mean, that's just a sample, really, of what's around. I think, for me, the interesting thing about disability and comedy is the issue of visibility. I mean, there are academics, you know, much more qualified than me to talk about this. My colleague Sean May has written about various forms of disability and comedy. Sharon Lockyer, a good friend of mine at Brunel University, who runs the Centre for Comedy Studies Research, has published on disability and comedy, and is, I think, doing ongoing research on that. But for me, what's interesting, just as somebody who hasn't expert knowledge on it, is how I think it's a sort of litmus test of our attitudes in general. So in other words, I think it would be, this will be come up in the interview, but I think it would be kind of impossible for a comedian with a visible disability to not mention it to an audience. There's no problem with that. I mean, comedians talk, we'll talk more about this later, but comedians talk about their experience, whatever their experience is. That's part of being a stand-up comedian. But I think there's more to it than that. I think that audiences expect it because they feel uncomfortable. And I think that if we ever get to the stage where a comedian with a visible disability doesn't have to talk about it, I think that will be a sign of significant social progress on disability. Just before we go into the interview, it was a really fantastic experience talking to Lee. I talked to him perhaps 2 hours before the show. I'd never met him before. I'd never talked to somebody who has to talk via a machine. I'd given him the questions in advance so that he could have typed his responses, which he could then cue using his finger. But actually, he was also able to give short answers by quickly typing things in. So it was the iPad. And the audio quality here is a bit odd because you'll hear his voice very nice and clear. And in the background, you'll hear me and sometimes Lee as well laughing at some of the things that have been said, ghostly in the distance. I was aware that I was kind of not necessarily being the most polite initially through my own ignorance, in that sense that I was kind of looking at the text and seeing what he did because I was sort of interested, rather than like you would do to any other human while they're talking to you and making eye contact. As soon as I sort of realised my mistake, I realised actually how interesting it is to have somebody who speaks mechanically, but their face is full of expression. And that was also true in the gig. There's a lot going on in the performance besides him just cueing pre-written sentences. So I think without further ado, let's hear the conversation I had with Lee.
Edit!
So you nominated something from Josie Long's collection, and we've picked out a leaflet, which I've got here, for her arts emergency organisation. So this is a benefit that happened, I'm not even sure the year, but it's a benefit for her organisation. What it says on the back, the Arts Emergency Service helps low-income students access higher education and tackles entrenched privilege in the arts by sharing it around. And I suppose my first question is, why did you nominate something from Josie's work? What is it about Josie Long's work that inspires you?
I've been a big fan of Josie Long for years now, so I've been inspired by her a lot. I discovered her work before I started to do stand-up myself. In fact, I think I first saw her in Edinburgh one year, when I was up there as a punter. And I've enjoyed her work ever since. So I guess you could say that she has been one of my influences, as I was developing as a comedian myself. I just love her whole outlook on life and the way that she can use comedy to get her point across in her own particular way. When you're watching her on stage, it's just like talking to a good friend down the pub. And you can also tell that she really believes in what she is saying, which I think is very hard to do in comedy sometimes. Because it comes from the heart, I think it makes people sit up and listen a bit more. That's an amazing skill to have. And, of course, she's probably one of the nicest comedians I have ever met, so it's very difficult not to like her. I especially like the fact that you've chosen an arts emergency leaflet, because I think that the project is just such a great thing, and I'm so glad that she's involved in it. Mainly because it means that it'll probably be a success. I actually donate to Arts Emergency every month. And I'm very grateful to be able to be in a position to do that. I really believe that doing comedy has changed my life so much. I'm very lucky to have had the opportunities I have had. So I think it's only right that we give other people the same chance to succeed in the arts. Regardless of their background or anything else. The arts should be for everybody. And that's why Arts Emergency is so important.
That's a very good answer. I hope you don't mind me commenting on the circumstance of the interview, because normally, I mean, my planning for interviews is shocking. It's just, you know, it's just basically throwing some ideas down and having them. But for this, because of the technical challenge of not wanting to sort of key in a ton of text to your iPad, you know, you had the questions in advance via email, and it's really interesting as an exchange between me and you, because I can sort of see the text beneath me and I can see you sort of cueing the next paragraph, but also we're making eye contact, and sort of that brings a kind of edge, a human element to the communication, if you see what I mean. We'll perhaps pick up on that in a moment. What was it that inspired you? You said that comedy changed your life. What was it that inspired you to get into stand-up, and when and where did you start?
I started doing comedy because my mate thought it would work well. Of course, I thought he was mental, but the idea stuck in the back of my head. Eventually, a few months later, I decided to give it a try because I knew I'd regret it if I didn't. It turns out my mate was right. It's just grown from there, really. It started 5 years ago when I did an open spot at a gig in Sunderland, but I've already done so much. It's still a bit breathtaking, really. I've supported Ross Noble at his gig, taken 5 shows to the Edinburgh Fringe, played in front of 2,000 people at a charity gig, and won the BBC New Comedy Award. Now I'm in the middle of writing a sitcom for Radio 4. It's been a crazy few years.
I mean, that's an amazing set of achievements in 5 years. I mean, most people sort of would spend 5 years working up to their first Edinburgh, right? And you're like 2,000 people supporting Ross Noble Radio 4 sitcom. Amazing. I said I wanted to sort of pick up on the technology that you use to communicate. So what are the technical challenges of using an iPad or a speech synthesizer to perform stand-up?
I write all my jokes and store them on my iPad in advance. Then I hook my iPad up to the sound system in the venue and just tap each joke when I want to say it. Obviously, this means that I'm pretty limited when it comes to audience banter and stuff. However, I'm working on ways on how I can be more interactive with the audience all the time. Of course, the voice is very monotone as well, so you can't sound excited or angry or whatever. It seems to be rather hard to understand over the phone as well. I'm sure some people just assume that I'm an answering machine and hang up on me. Technology has come a long way from my first communication device, though, which had such a terrible voice. So hopefully things will only get better. In the sense of comedy, I think there's positives to come out of this, though. For example, I can use the awkward pauses and stuff to great comic effect. And I think the posh voice makes it funnier as well.
It really does. Also, there's a lot going on with your face. I mean, you know, I mentioned that just talking, you're communicating a lot with your face. And of course we do as humans. I'm sure that fills in a lot of the gaps for the audience. My next question is because I looked through some of the material that you've kindly donated to the archive, and I was looking through this earlier today. There was a thing where it talks about dealing with hecklers or something, or repartee that I saw in here. How do you deal with hecklers? Because, you know, that's a major challenge, right?
As a matter of fact, I am still yet to be heckled. Which is rather disappointing, really. Because I do have some comebacks stored, just in case. And I'm dying to use them.
Can we try one now? What if I heckle you and you do one? Can we do that? Superb. All right. Get off your shit!
Yes. Well, Stephen Hawking fucked your mother. Then let her run the virus checker.
Yeah, that's good. That's really good. Oh, amazing. So now there's politics in Josie's act, and there's politics in your act. You talked about the positive, beneficial effects of comedy. So do you think that comedy can change people's minds, for example, by challenging their attitudes to disability?
I think that comedy can be at the forefront of changing people's attitudes. Mainly because comedy has played that role in the past, certainly in my case at least. I've always seen the funny side of my disability, really. If I didn't laugh about it, then I definitely cry. And I've always used that humor as a defense mechanism. If I could laugh at myself, then it meant that no one else could laugh at me. It helped take some of the stigma away from being deformed, and also helped deal with the elephant in the room. I've had first-hand experience of facing an audience who weren't sure about the disabled bloke on stage at the start of the night. Could they laugh? Should they feel sorry for me? Where the hell was my carer? But by the end of the night, they had forgotten all of that, and were just enjoying someone telling jokes for a living. I won't mention the time I got asked if I was a character act after a gig. Some people are beyond help. And that's why I would like to see more disabled comedians booked by comedy clubs, appearing at festivals and being shown on television. Basically, more disabled people being portrayed in a positive light. The comedy scene as a whole can play a big part in this. There's some amazing disabled comedians working on the circuit. And comedy is the perfect way to tackle difficult subjects in a way that can make people both laugh and think at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. I think that, you know, there are a lot of disabled comedians out there, and, you know, from what I know, it can be harder to get onto TV and things like that. And I mean, the thing is, great ones as well, right? There's something that there's a question I phrase it in the email, and I you know, I don't know if I phrase it right, but my question is this. It seems to me that, you know, you talk about disability in your act because that's your experience. That's like what we all do. We talk about our experience. But do you think that if audiences see a comedian with a visible, tangible disability, that we'll ever get to the stage where they just go, well, they don't necessarily have to talk about that? Do you see what I mean? In other words, do you think that we'll get to the stage where somebody could come on with a visible disability and people go, well, I don't expect them to talk about that?
I hope not, because then I'd have to write loads of new material, and I'm just too lazy for that. Seriously, though, I think it might happen one day. Probably not in my lifetime, though. Like I say, disabled people need to be integrated into society a lot more before we can see that start to happen at all. As a society, I just don't think we are ready for that yet.
Yeah, I think you're right, sadly, because I mean, apart from the fact of you having to write new material, I suppose my point is that you could now have a black British comedian say, and they wouldn't have to talk about being black, because we've sort of, it's not like racism has disappeared, but we've made progress, I think, whereas I think there's a long way to go with disability in that regard. So now, here's my final thing. So you picked out something from Josie's collection, whereas I think we should have a contest and see which should be the actual object for this episode, because lovely though Josie is, brilliant though she is, and great though the Arts Emergency is, I think that this is significant. And I think that I would like to nominate, for example, this leaflet of Lost Voice Guide, Voice of Choice, with quotes from Ross Noble and indeed The Guardian on the front, or this one, Disability for Dunces, with a bunch of, well, I like this. So what you put on the back is presumably the dumb stuff people say to you, right? So, can you really not talk? Have you considered an exorcist? These are funny. Are you just there for parking? Are you as clever as Stephen Hawking? Do you have sex? Seriously, can you not talk at all? I have two kids with a hidden disability. They have type 1 diabetes, and I've done gigs about that and, you know, talked about the dumb stuff that, and collected things that other people affected by that particular condition have. And I think that's really clever as a way of sort of addressing people's idiocy, I suppose. This I'd like to propose this one, Laughter is the Worst Medicine, a show that you did about a sort of brush with the Reaper, I suppose. And check these reviews out, for example. Guardian, finding humour in strange places is one of Lost Boys Guy's strengths. Herald, an Edinburgh Fringe one-off, think Stephen Hawking reading the BBC in the 1950s via a device programmed by the writers of Viz. I mean, you know, people would kill for a quote like that. Funny, personal, occasionally shocking and frequently mischievous. The funniest comedian at the Edinburgh Fringe, his banter with the audience is one of the best I've witnessed. That's the thing I was trying to find earlier, banter with the audience, right? I think these are worthy of our object, right, for an episode. So what do you think? Is it Josie or is it you?
Well, the Arts Emergency leaflet actually has a good reason to be picked. Whereas I just talk a load of shit on stage and seem to get away with it. So there's no competition, really.
Do you know what? I think you win. I think that we might call this episode something like Lost Voice Guy Refuses to Choose His Own Object.
You can't disagree with a disabled bloke anyway.
Now, if I may comment on that, because that's a funny thing to say, but I mean, in a way, you know, that answer, I mean, you, when you did the heckle put down before, you had to sort of scroll around bits of apps and things on your pad, and you had a pre-made one, but actually you keyed that in pretty quick.
Yes. I do often wonder if I could do that on stage. But I guess it takes me out of my comfort zone a bit too much.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's true. And actually, you know, if you want anything other than a quick one-liner, then it's too long. Lee, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Are you okay with us taping your gig tonight?
Of course, as long as you don't heckle.
Cool, thank you so much.
Edit.
So yeah, that was the interview. Elspeth, you listened to that quite recently. What did you make of it?
Well, I took some notes when I listened.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
There's a few points that I'd like to sort of talk about. The first is kind of the voice, like the voice that he uses, which I found quite interesting. The way he talked about kind of the poshness of the voice and kind of the angle that brought to his act, but also kind of the monotone nature of it. And I think that lends itself really well to to comedy. It's very deadpan. But I also found it interesting. Yeah,
only because there's a funny thing about that when I was doing my PhD back in the 80s, early 90s, I read a lot of kind of psychology experiments on comedy, and often you just went, oh, how did you do that so badly? Mm. Like the whole premise, the way it's set up, doesn't understand the way that people appreciate comedy. So, for example, there was one where they wanted to find out what the operative word in a joke was. So they wrote it on a long roll of paper and then they rolled it like past a window in the wall, like past that showed one word at a time. And what they found was that people laughed far more at the apparatus than the joke itself. But also there was another one where they would, I think it might be the same one, where they wanted to find out or it was a similar one probably, they wanted to find out the effect of delivery. So they had some people reading the joke out, like trying to deliver it, and they had some people reading it out in a monotone, and they found they got a lot more laughter from the person who's deliberately taking all inflection out of their voice than they did for the person who's you know, speaking normally. So I completely agree. I think that hearing humorous content through something as formal as a computer-generated voice, that is funny.
And I wonder how much Lee structures his jokes kind of based on the way it will sound and come out of the machine, if that makes any sense. Because he also talks about the pauses, and I found that really interesting, because I think in previous episodes we've talked about kind of the rhythm and the pauses kind of in comedy, and I found that interesting as well, the way that actually the pauses of the machine and kind of between jokes also lends itself to kind of the way that he's maybe structuring his jokes.
His jokes are written out, I think, in sort of short paragraphs, and each one can be cued or has to be cued, so it won't just run on. That allows him to time things around the audience's laughter. And I'd be amazed if he didn't have quite a skilled and practiced sense of how to structure his material. Mm. It's also quite interesting in terms of generating material because, you know, I mean, I never write a verbatim script, and many comedians don't. It's just bullet points or, you know, jotted notes or rough approximation of what you're going to say. But obviously with Lee, it has to be precise. So that's quite interesting because the thing that he's cueing is his script and it will come out like that. You know, it won't change on the night because it's a machine. But yeah, he's a human who's cueing it. And also, you know, he's, as he's speaking through his machine, you know, he's also gesturing with his hands and, you know, as I say, a lot going on in his face. Mm. What else did you think?
I suppose at the end, kind of, well, talking about using comedy as a way to talk about your experiences and your personal experiences, and using comedy as a way to tackle difficult subjects. So getting people to think as well as laugh. And kind of that was a really important point that I sort of took away from the interview. And yeah, it was interesting, the discussion that you had and which we picked up on before kind of the interview about whether disabled comedians have to refer to their disability or not.
Well, I think there's a thing that... there's the idea that people with... Because I think I keep coming back to this thing about visible disability. I mean, we have material in our collection from Tin and Duyeb, who has type 1 diabetes, and as do my two sons. Not everybody who has diabetes considers it to be a disability, but it is recognised as a hidden disability by a lot of people. But obviously you don't see somebody and go, wow, he's diabetic. But if you've got something physically different about you, people will notice that. That's the key. So Tiernan can choose to talk about his diabetes on stage, but it's not a choice for people with a visible disability, I think. Mm-hmm. They have to kind of acknowledge that. But I think there's something else going on. Like, you know, I've heard it talked about as a defence mechanism. But actually, I think it's a sign of great generosity in people with visible disabilities. Because what they're doing is putting people at their ease by joking about it. Like, actually, if we have a problem with those people, that is our problem. That is our weakness. It's not theirs. But the fact is they live in a world where it's not seen that way, right, by most people. Mm. And I think that using humour... I mean, we had a show last night, a student show, and there was a student who has a visible disability who identifies as blind. She is very funny talking about about that. And I think that it's just brilliant that she makes other people feel comfortable with her by making funny jokes, rewarding them, you know, in advance for treating her like anybody else, by acknowledging her condition, you know, through jokes.
Yeah. And has that... It sounded like that was still the case in the 80s.
Yeah.
And that's still, yeah.
Yeah, it's still the case. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting because I think, you know, I mean, everybody talks about who they are anyway. I mean, you were talking about the effect of, you know, increasing understanding. I think if you listen to somebody, I think that's the great thing about stand-up is that stand-up is essentially an individual talking to a bigger community, right? And the individual will always be sort of talking about how the world looks from their perspective, even if they're not, you know, anything like themselves. If they're a character comedian, to some extent they're reflecting the worldview of the comedian. So Al Murray, Pub Landlord, for example, is reflecting his views of people like the pub landlord, you know. But I mean, for comedians who appear as themselves, I think they're always articulating a worldview. And so, you know, if you hear somebody who's from a group that you're not part of talking about what the world looks like from their angle, I mean, say the great African-American comedian Dick Gregory, who died this year. I mean, yeah, he was the first African-American comedian to have a breakthrough and play to mixed-race audiences. His big breakthrough was playing the Playboy Club in Chicago in the early 60s, as a replacement act. And there were a bunch of Southern businessmen there, white Southern businessmen, and he was told that he didn't have to perform, but he insisted on performing. And when you listen to the recordings of Dick Gregory, he was fantastic, just articulating what it was like to be him, what it was like to be a black person at that time in America, sort of before the civil rights movement had been you know, successful. And of course, it's not like racism has completely gone now anyway. I mean, there's the Black Lives Matter, the very necessary Black Lives Matter campaign. So to relate that to this, you know, for us, for people who do not have a disability, to hear what the world's like for people who do, I think that helps understanding, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I think that's really, that's the brilliant thing about stand-up. If you like stand-up, I think that's a really good, you know, plus point that people who don't like it, you can say, yeah, but, you know, we help to sort of break down prejudice. Of course, the counter-argument is historically stand-ups also reinforce prejudice in all kinds of different ways. But, you know, I think things like Lost Voice Guy definitely helps to break down prejudice. It was quite funny as well. I liked his response to... when I said, which of these are we going to have? And he said, Josie Long, not his own leaflet. And I said, yeah, okay. And he went, oh, it's just because, well, you've heard him in the episode anyway, but just because I'm disabled, you couldn't let me lose. But I think really it should have been his leaflet, because I think that he's important.
I think so, although he did articulate a good argument.
He did.
As being kind of important to him.
I agree, and also...
and the importance of the organisation and ensuring that the arts are for everyone. So I agree with you, but Lee did make a good argument.
He made a good case. And of course, Josie Long rocks. Yeah. So, you know, that helps too. And also, again, it's nice to see connections between the collections. Mm. Did you have anything else in your notes?
I just loved the heckle, like kind of the way he approaches hecklers, or not, often.
Yeah.
But I like that he's got some pre-programmed kind of heckle comebacks.
Absolutely. I'll tell you what that reminds me of a bit, actually, is Howard Reed. Do you know Howard Reed?
Yeah.
Big Howard and Little Howard. That Little Howard can interact with audiences. So he it's the same sort of idea. He has pre-programmed things to say. So you can ask Little Howard questions and things. And apparently that was inspired by a comment by Simon Munnery, where Simon Munnery was with somebody else, I forget who, presumably Howard Reed. But I think somebody else was involved. And they were at the Comedy Store, I think, and they were watching a comedian coming out with the standard ploys, putting down hecklers, standard audience banter. And apparently Simon Munnery turned around Riley and said, one day all of this will be done by machine. And, apparently that was the thing that sparked the idea of Howard Reed doing Little Howard. This, if you don't know, it's a computer-generated six-year-old boy who appears on a screen next to him and he interacts with it. But then Little Howard can also interact with the audience. It's another highly recommended act. I suppose we should wrap up by saying that... there's some fantastic disabled comedians out there, and to highly recommend going to see them, but in particular Lost Voice Guy, who totally rocks. But of course, this podcast isn't just about us talking to you, it's also about you getting involved.
Get involved!
There are various ways to get involved, but first you'll need to know how to contact us. Our email address is standup@kent.ac.uk. We're also on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @histcompod.
So the first way of getting involved is go to the catalogue, which you can find online, find a listing for a comedy object and nominate it. We'll talk about all nominated objects in future episodes. That's the vanilla version of getting involved.
The chocolate chip version of getting involved is to come and visit the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive in person. We're based at the Templeman Library at the University of Kent. Record a short piece about the material that you've looked at, send us the audio, and we'll feature it in a future episode.
And the silliest way of getting involved is to record your own cover version of our podcast theme tune, and we will use it, if we like it, in a future episode. All of these ways of getting involved can earn you prizes, like, for example, badges for the podcast, a T-shirt for the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive. So it's definitely worth letting us know about you getting involved.
A History of Comedy in Several Objects is devised and presented by Dr. Oliver Double and Elspeth Miller for the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive, brought to you by the University of Kent. This is made possible by the University of Kent's Public Engagement Research Fund. Photography by Matt Wilson, and editing and production by Matt Hoss.